began last week to talk about the subject of the way discipline and grace go together. I looked especially at Titus 2, verses 11 and 12, that say this: "For the grace of God that brings salvation has appeared to all men. It teaches us to say no to ungodliness and worldly passions, and to live self-controlled, upright, and godly lives in this present age." Last week I introduced the main idea that Jerry Bridges puts out in his book in this chapter that's listed on your study guide. The grace that brought salvation to you is the same grace that teaches or disciplines you. But you must respond on the basis of grace, not law. That is why you must preach the gospel to yourself every day. I focused on the first half of that, that it's the same grace that brings salvation that also teaches or disciplines you. With that in mind, we're going to press on today to get into the more practical side of this passage in Titus, where it says that the grace of God teaches us two things: to say no to ungodliness and worldly passions, and second, on the positive side, to live self-controlled, upright, and godly lives. This is the area of discipline, and we focused on the grace that is part of the Christian life and how that grace brings salvation, but then it also brings this lively Christian life that is growing. So if you have a study guide, look at number 2. I want to ask your response to this. What are some of the disciplines of the Christian life to which you were first exposed when you became a Christian? I'll pause there and just ask you to answer that. What are some of the disciplines of the Christian life?
Resting on Sunday.
Mm-hmm. Reading my Bible regularly.
Mm-hmm. Good. Bible, prayer, Sunday rest.
Psalms.
Singing psalms. Mm-hmm. Pardon me?
Tithing.
Yeah, tithing. Good.
Fasting.
Fasting. Mm-hmm. Meditating. Meditating. Good. Is there somebody else? There's a really nice book by a man named Whitney that details each of these and spends time meditating on them. I'm not going to go deeply into each of one of those today. Let me go on to ask this one. Did you and do you still approach them from the realm of shoulda, oughta, gotta? Sounds like some 60s rock and roll song or something. Or of grace. What's the difference? Do you know what I mean by shoulda, oughta, gotta?
Checklist.
Okay, so approaching those disciplines as I've got to do these things. I should have done these things. Did you or do you still think of the disciplines in that fashion?
Times it's hard not to.
Yeah.
Easy to fall into.
Yeah.
Part of it is because we know it's something we should be doing. Like, it's something that it's important to your spiritual life to be practicing those things. And so, you know, I need to be doing this, so why aren't I?
Mm-hmm.
Why am I more motivated to do this? So you feel that I need.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's very honest. I appreciate that. And I hope the younger children will be hearing your older brothers and sisters and your parents speak of the Christian life in this way, as understanding the way we is set out for us to live and pursuing those things, but pursuing them out of grace rather than out of duty. What's the difference between those two things? What's the difference between grace and duty?
All the glory goes to God with grace. Mm-hmm. And it's shoulda, oughta, gotta. It's kind of personally based.
If you fulfill the checklist, then you earned something. You deserve something. Mm-hmm. What else?
It should be an honor to come to Christ and to pray to the Lord, and therefore that's what happens when we come to Him for grace.
Mm-hmm.
It should be a privilege to be praying, as opposed to when I pray to do it.
Well said. Yeah. For the kids, you might think of, you put it this way, I have to do my math homework, or I get to go out with mom and dad. Those are two different ways of approaching something, aren't they? Joseph, when you have to do something, what's your face look like? I'm putting him on the spot here. That's not fair. How about this? Children, if your parents said, I'd like to take you out to dinner tonight, to your favorite restaurant, what does your face look like then? Yeah. So when our relationship with God is through grace, there's honor, there's privilege that's expressed there. The shoulda, oughta, gotta has that sense of duty and drudgery and something that you just have to suffer through. I do appreciate your honesty in answering those things, though, because the aspects of the Christian life that are routine do take on sometimes the character of duty because of that high bar that is set in front of us, that and it's very easy to slip into the mentality of doing these things to avert disaster, gain God's favor, earn salvation, whatever. And it's easy to slip into that. I'll refer you back to last week, though, then, to see that grace brought salvation and grace trains you. Those two things do and ought to go together. To press on then to the disciplines, I'm just going to talk about the two broad things that Paul brings up here in Titus chapter 2. First of all, saying no to ungodliness and worldly passions. Ungodliness is a word that stands for a rather big category of sin. It can be mistakenly, though, sometimes given over to those things that we might characterize in our thinking as sins that are bigger than others. Murder, adultery, and things like that. Those are really characteristic of ungodliness. But the Bible uses the word to describe all manner of sins. Sins that are big and small. This morning in the service I referenced Romans 1. It's a passage like in other places, there are some lists of some of the characteristics of rebellious human nature. In verses 18 to 32 of Romans 1, there are a variety of different things in there. I want to invite you to turn there and ask for a volunteer to read Romans 1, 18 through 32.
I'm going to have to be able to read.
Jeff, thank you. Yes, please.
For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth and unrighteousness. Because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. For since the creation of the world is invisible, invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse, because, although they knew God, they did not glorify Him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools, and changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man, and birds and four-footed animals and creeping things. Therefore God also gave them up to uncleanness and the lust of their hearts, to dishonor their bodies among themselves, who exchanged the truth of God for the lie, and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. For this reason God gave them up to vile passions, leaving the women exchange the natural use for what is against nature. Likewise also the men, leaving the natural use of the woman, burning their lust for one another, men with men committing what is shameful, receiving in themselves the penalty of their error which was due. And even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a debased mind to do those things which are not fitting, being filled with all unrighteousness, sexual immorality, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, evil-mindedness. They are whisperers, backbiters, haters of God, violent, proud, boasters, inventors of evil things, disobedient to parents, undiscerning, untrustworthy, unloving, unforgiving, unmerciful, who, knowing the righteous judgment of God, those who practice such things are deserving of death, not only do the same, but also approve of those who practice them.
This is a description of ungodliness. Paul does here mention some of those sins that that we would categorize as big sins. There are some sins that are more heinous in the sight of God than others. They have consequences. There's violence that involves many other people. So there are some big sins here. But he also condemns something more basic as ungodliness. You see it here, any disregard for God, any ignoring of Him, any way that you do not take Him into account in your life, even the lack of fear or reverence for God is characterized here as ungodliness, and it should be identified as such. Think of your own conversion and how the habits of your life are reshaped when Christ got a hold of you. Before your conversion, the world revolved around yourself, and all the things you did were to suit the needs and the desires that you had. That really is ungodliness. It just is much by definition as anything else. You are rejecting God and worshiping and serving yourself. But at conversion, when Christ enters your heart, He remakes it by His grace. There's the saving part of it. You're set free from Satan and the punishments of your sin. But you're also set free to be a new creation in Jesus Christ. You have a new nature. There are still old habits that are clinging to us. And that's why Paul will talk about putting those things off and putting on Jesus Christ. Grace addresses those habits. It addresses us in a way that is a process of training. By grace you say no to these aspects of ungodliness. Paul also identifies worldly passions here. I especially like 1 John 2:15-17 as a description of worldly passions. I recently preached on 1 John. I won't go deep into this passage, but draw out several things here that I want you to understand. Who will read 1 John 2, verses 15-17? Okay, Sam?
Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the desires of the flesh and the desires of the eyes and pride in possessions, is not from the Father, but is from the world. And the world is passing away along with its desires. But whoever does the will of God abides forever.
Earlier in this chapter and in the book, John has been talking about loving God and warning about loving the world. The comparison that I remember making in this passage is the comparison of oil and water. The two things don't mix. It doesn't go together for you to love God and to love the world. John warns against loving the world and gives three different examples of that. They're not exhaustive, but they provide some very helpful ways for you to understand what it looks like to be caught up with worldly passions or love for the world. They're the desire of the flesh, or actually I like the way the New King James says it, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. Those are the three different divisions that are given here. Lust of the flesh refers to indulgence, lack of moderation, the desires for sometimes good things can be given an inordinate expression, no moderation in sexual appetite or in just the physical appetites of eating or drinking. Those things can become worldly desires that are indulged and immoderate. I like the way Pastor Boyce speaks of it. He says it's to live a life which is dominated by the senses. It is to be gluttonous in food, effeminate in luxury, slavish in pleasure, lustful and lax in morals, selfish in the use of possessions, regardless of all the spiritual values, extravagant in the gratification of worldly, earthly, and material desires. The flesh's desire is forgetful of, blind to, and regardless of the commandments of God. You can see how that doesn't mix with a fear of the Lord. Instead, it reflects that old nature. It reflects the spiritual battle that we have to put those things off, and here, the lust of the flesh. Lust of the eyes could be well characterized as covetousness. You see something, you want something. That's what covetousness is. You see something that you don't have, but somebody else has, and you want it for yourself. That's the lust of the eyes, or covetousness. There is a healthy desire for things. It's not wrong to set your heart on attaining something, even some possessions. But those desires can also become immoderate. Just like with lust of the flesh, where there can be godly desires or godly things that you want, you can want something that in an immoderate or inordinate way. Lust of the eyes I usually also think of in terms of lust for the material possessions of this world. The next one I think is going to, under the pride of life, has in mind more of the immaterial things of this life. So material things of this world that you see around you and come to desire. Things like a new car, or a fixed one, or no, a new computer that won't kind of slog around and always be stuttering. A new phone. Have you ever noticed all of the brand new phones with all their bells and whistles, and thought, boy, it'd be nice to have one of those? Those things can become controlling and take a place in your life that crowds out your desire for God or love for God. Pride of life. This is where I say I think that this one turns towards some of the desires for things that aren't material. Things like success or position, promotion, fame, glamour. Those are things that aren't necessarily available at Walmart or on Amazon.com. They're the stuff of life. It's very tempting for you to notice a fellow student that is very popular and wants to have that popularity. Or it's very easy to notice someone else who got promoted and you didn't, and be distracted from your love for God. Grace teaches you to say no to these things. Paul puts it very simply, but very powerfully. He says, say no to worldly passions and ungodliness. Say no to preoccupation with things. Say no to taking offense when you're overlooked or when you're not as popular. Say no to the temptation that rises in your neighborhood or your workplace. All of these are things that grace teaches you how to deal with. In another place, Paul says, those who use the things of the world should live as if not engrossed in them, for this world in its present form is passing away. It's 1 Corinthians 7:31. What he's saying there is that we are earthly creatures. We live in the world, and we make use of cars and computers and phones. We have success. There are interpersonal relationships. Those are part of our world. Live in this world, but live in it in such a way as to not be engrossed in them. Don't be consumed by them. Learn to say no to the inordinate desire for the things of this world. For this world and its present form is passing away. On the opposite side, there's a positive. Learn to say yes to godliness. Paul says it this way. He says, grace trains you to live self-controlled, upright, and godly lives. Here again, he had two phrases, and saying yes, he has three phrases, and in a sense, they form a little bit of the opposite to the negatives that I've already been describing. So there, you say no to ungodliness. The opposite is to say yes to godliness. Say no to sexual immorality. Say yes to purity and to honor. You could take the opposite to all of those and put them in here. But Paul does use these three words, and a couple commentators trace them out in a way that suggests that the three words have something to say about you yourself personally, first of all, self-controlled, you and your relationships with others being upright, and you and your relationship with God leading a godly life. And there's some value to that. There are three specific areas of training and of growth that is set before you by grace. Being self-controlled. Think of it as restraint. Think of it as the denial of sinful desires. That would be the negative. Not just the denial, though, but the healthy pursuit of righteous desires. Find out what legitimate goods are and set your mind on these things. That's what Paul says in Philippians 4:8. Whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is lovely, whatever is of good report, think on these things. Pursue these things. There's self-control. You could even take the list from 1 John 2 that I gave, the lust of the flesh, of the eyes, and the pride of life. Think of the denial that's necessary there that is part of self-control, but then think of the positive side, the opposite good that controls those things. This is important because all too often we make excuses about our actions because we say we couldn't control our desires or our urges. Have you heard somebody say that? I couldn't help myself in this situation. They're making themselves out to be little more than an animal. But you're not an animal. You're a child of God who's received grace. Because of that, it's grace that's set you free, free from those desires and free to live a life that controls and directs your desires in godly fashions. Being upright. Again, this is the relationship of you and in a community, you and others, has in mind acting justly and faithfully towards others in your family, your church, and your community. In this case, sometimes the lust of the eyes is especially apparent in this one. Covetousness usually has in mind something that somebody else has that I don't have. It can lead to greed. It can lead to taking action on that greed, to stealing, taking away others' property, taking away others' good names. Here again, the path of grace teaches you to put those things off and to put on godliness, to put on the godliness of contentment in your possessions and in your calling in life. To put on the sense of upholding the property and reputations and status of others. Those are things that you can pursue. And there's the putting off and putting on that's part of that. And thirdly, leading godly lives. Grace teaches you to be trained in a godly life. This describes being in step with God, desiring His glory and pursuing His will. Think here of the sins of the pride of life. Pride revolves around self. Earlier I described imagining yourself before your conversion and how you were at the center of that world and you were doing everything to serve yourself. Being godly renounces elevating yourself and instead humbles yourself before the one who rescued you from Satan. God is the one who forgave your debts, covered your shame, gave you mercy and peace. He is the one that is honored by your love and obedience. Finally, then, I'll just call your attention to that word trained again. Training has the idea of practice. It's kind of funny, this came up a couple of times this week. It came up in Dilbert. How many hours does it take to master something? Did anybody read Dilbert this week? Guess how many hours it takes to master an instrument, a foreign language?
100 hours?
More.
A couple years?
10,000. 10,000 hours is what they say it takes to master something. I meant to cut out Dilbert and bring it today. You can look back this week. It's pretty funny. Think about it in this fashion. I know a lot of you love music and play an instrument. You probably have some favorite artists that you like to listen to, somebody that is really good at the harp or really good at the guitar or piano or singing. You love listening to them and you think, I want to be like them. But then when you pick up the instrument or when you sing, it doesn't quite sound the same. That's because you're just starting. You're in the beginning stages of mastering that. You're in the beginning stages of training. if it's something that you love, it's something that that is not burdensome to you either. It's not the type of thing that you oughta, shoulda, gotta do. Instead, it's something that you really do long for and find is very appealing. It is training, nonetheless. It takes time. It takes practice. It takes deliberateness in giving yourself to these things. And that's where grace comes back in again. Grace enlivens that process. It spurs you on. It encourages you to see the call of Christ that you have, that upward call of Christ. In other words, He has saved you, redeemed you, and forgiven you, and is calling you upward. And that is inspiring as you think of holiness and the practice of that holiness, so that you pursue it with diligence and with a deliberateness, but not because you're gaining merit, but instead it's all of grace. It is all of grace. I can't underline that enough. If you don't approach it that way, you'll kill yourself trying. But since it is of grace, go and love what God is calling you to and pursue it with all your heart. Any questions or comments as we close today? I invite you to bow in prayer with me. God, we're so glad that our relationship with You is all of grace. Thank You that You have redeemed us from our self-centered, self-worshipping, self-seeking lives. God, You have set us free from that rat race. And we're so glad that instead You have set us on the Christian life, that upward call that You have given to us. Lord, by grace You have saved us through faith, and that grace is not of ourselves, it is Your gift. Lord, You have also prepared for us beforehand good works that we should walk in them. Lord, because of grace, because of Your love, help us to respond in love back to You. Help us to see the honor of following after You, and to pursue it with all our hearts. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you. You're dismissed.